You're listening to Radio Boston. Do you want to know the secrets to good writing? Arlington-based author Steve Allman has a new book out about the craft. He's written a dozen fiction and nonfiction books, and he's taught writing for 30 years. His latest book is Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories. I spoke to him earlier this week, and our conversation wasn't as much about the mechanics of writing as it was about what Steve calls looking into our inner lives. I start by asking him why he wanted to write this book.
The big trick with writing, and it's probably the same with any creative endeavor, is like nirvana for you is when you're more interested in the thing you're doing than whether you're doing it well.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I'd been teaching for 30 years, and I'd spent a lot of time, most of that time, frankly, failing, just screwing up right, left, and center. And I felt like when I finally, in my mid-50s, he said delicately, like was able to figure out how to write a novel and get it published, because that had been my white whale for a long time, I think some part of me said, okay, I would like to take some of what I've dealt with in my writing career, my teaching career, and put it in a common sense book about the creative process and storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the title. How did you come up with that?
Yeah, the title's kind of weird. It's like supposedly a craft book. I think of it as more like a book about the creative process, but it's technically a craft book, right? It's got craft stuff in it. The message in the book is really like, to the extent that you are able to be merciful and forgiving and understanding, that's as far as you're going to travel into the truth. If you're trying to tell a story, especially a story that you've been discouraged from telling, or your family or the culture around you is saying, I don't want to hear that story. That story is disruptive to our systems of power. There's a resistance against it. There's a kind of code of silence around it. The way I think of it is almost an inverse relationship. Like the more force, the more the world's trying to keep you quiet and suppress that story, that's exactly how much it matters that that story get told.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to battle through that internalized resistance. And the way that people, I think, keep themselves from telling the full truth is they imagine a bad outcome. Their family would be mad at them, or they get into some sort of trouble. And what I'm trying to say with the title is, look, you know, truth is the arrow. Your job as a writer is to tell the truth, and you're only going to get as far into the truth as mercy gets you. You have to believe that you're going back into those painful rooms in an effort to understand why everybody did what they did and why they had to do that.
I had this moment where at first when I was reading the book, I said, I'm not really a writer, right? So
right.
I was having some static and trying to connect with the words on the page. But then I stepped back and I remembered our lives are colored by the stories we tell ourselves. And then the book opened up to me more.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Was that your intention with this book?
Yeah, look, everybody's a storyteller. Mm-hmm. Everybody's telling the story of their lives because they're trying to understand it. Sometimes
yeah.
they're trying to control it. Sometimes they're trying to build a certain case that makes them feel all right about a loss or a disappointment or, you know, a judgment that's being put on them. But everybody is constantly engaged in this story. And that's how human beings deal with their big brains and their conflicted hearts and their confused spirits. I'm convinced of it.
You encourage people to write about their obsessions. Why?
Well, the way I say it to writing students is you write about what you can't get rid of by other means. That's just how it works. That's why it's sticking around. Like, pay attention to your attention, trust your memory. And to me, the default setting for humankind is obsession. Like when you, I don't know if you are, have been around kids recently, but you were a kid once, like they're obsessed openly. They're born into a state of obsession. They're hungry. They want comfort. They need to be changed. Whatever it is, there's no bargaining. They're just totally obsessed with it. And in childhood, because we're less defended, we haven't been socialized yet, we're totally obsessed with whatever it is that we love. We give ourselves to it entirely, completely emotionally, which is such a beautiful and dangerous and disruptive place to be. And so I feel like your job as a writer in a way is to reconnect to those obsessions. Every time I failed at one of those awful novels, I would go into a depression, and then some forgiving part of me would say, well, let me forget about the book I should be writing. Forget that. I can't do that. What's the book that I want to write or that I feel capable of writing? And what did I do? I returned to my obsessions over and over again. Candy, the moral complexity of football, my love for it, the way I hate myself for loving it, the political dysfunction of this country and how we got there, my favorite novel, Stoner by John Williams. I returned to those obsessions because there, I was writing that book already inside me. When you're obsessed with something, it's the arrest of your attention in the midst of distraction. And it's something you feel you should be ashamed of, but I think actually it's the most natural thing in the world. And the reader attaches to it intuitively because the reader's asking two questions when they enter any story. Who do I care about and what do they care about?
I do want to get into some of your teaching. Just what you say about what you've seen over your years of teaching. And you come across this constant problem with your students and you call it something... You call it emotional cowardice.
Yeah.
That's heavy. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think cowardice is like a really patriarchal word. I don't know. In my head, maybe it's my problem, but it's like somehow that it's like somebody's weak or coward. I think it's reasonable to be frightened of big emotions. Mm-hmm. I think about how much of your life is devoted to avoiding conflict. Mine's probably like 75% of my life is avoiding conflict in some way. And the same thing is true when it comes to feelings of deep vulnerability, helplessness, doubt, whatever it is. Like, it feels good when we can get there, but we don't let ourselves get there a lot, especially men in patriarchal culture, okay? And so it's hard for us to allow our characters to go there, and it's really disruptive. And it's hard, especially if you're writing autobiographical stuff. So when I say that about my students, it's really hard to go there emotionally. It's disruptive to your life. And in your civilian life, away from the keyboard, you're kind of always constantly trying to avoid it. And in fact, like the way in which we feel about the world, that we're obsessive by nature, and that those obsessive feelings sometimes get us into trouble, and they make us, I don't know, unacceptable as students or partners or whatever it is. We care too much, we feel too much. We're socialized away from that kind of extreme feeling. And so it's not a coincidence that oftentimes I'll read work where everything is engineered to push a character into real disequilibrium, real emotional and psychic crisis. And frankly, that's why I'm there as a reader. I want to know that other people reach those points of desperation, of confusion, of sorrow, and maybe on the other side of it, of some kind of hope that they keep intact, some faith. But oftentimes I don't get there in my work. And my students don't either. They kind of, it's like a game of chicken and they swerve. And my job as a teacher is to say, press harder or slow down where it hurts, because that's the place that I arrived. That's where I want to get to, because I'm hurting in that way too.
Mm-hmm. 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 And you have a line in there where you say, we are in the end a product of the stories we tell.
Right.
And you also have another one where you're talking about literature. You say literature offers a deeper way of thinking and feeling in the world. And I saw that, for me, that really clicked for me in the section about characters. Because in your novel, All the Secrets of the World,
that's
right?
It.
You're writing about Nancy Reagan, who was a much more complex character than you anticipated. So could you please just read that passage real quick?
In the drafting of my most recent novel, I invoked this process every time a new character emerged, and the process is asking what internal conflicts are driving the character. At a certain point, to my shock and dismay, I realized that Nancy Reagan was going to be central to the action. I had spent 40 years flattening the former First Lady into a caricature, a modern Marie Antoinette hooked on couture and astrology. As a novelist, I had to start asking who Nancy might be beyond my bigoted version. This required more than curiosity. I had to study her history to understand how she might see the world. And I'll tell you, Daryl, like, Nancy Reagan is somebody who, in the novel and in my own, like, I grew up in the Reagan era.
A very polarizing presidency, to say the least.
We were just getting warmed up as a country, but you know that. But Nancy Reagan, in my own imagination, was a very superficial person. Just say no. That's the solution to addiction, mm-hmm. right? And the plague of, you know, whatever it is that was, sort of taking over in the crack epidemic or whatever. Very simplistic view of the world. But when I started to think about Nancy Reagan as a character in my novel, this is what I love about novels and creative writing, is you have to go in search of forgiveness. You have to go in search of understanding. That's it. That's the whole thing. You have to be like Christ ministering to the iniquitous and to the depraved. You cannot be just there sort of dividing the world into good and evil. Mm-hmm. So when I thought about Nancy Reagan and I read about her history, I thought, okay, here's a woman who believed her husband was destined. She was like his prophet. She believed he was destined to lead the country to this like grand future. And I think that future was shot through with white supremacy and patriarchy and all the rest of it. But whatever, I'm not talking about what Steve Allman believes. I'm talking about what Nancy Reagan mm-hmm. believed. Mm-hmm. She believed that. And she sees him after years of devotion and, you know, preaching this and having this story in her head. Reagan does it. He's elected. And it's like this moment where his vision and her belief in his vision has finally been realized. And 2 months into office, an assassin puts a bullet into his chest, and it's lodged a quarter of an inch from his heart.
Mm-hmm.
And she shows up at the hospital. And at that moment in my novel, and I think to some extent in real life, she just adopted whatever belief system she believed would keep her beloved safe. And that I could understand. I understand what it's like to see somebody who's in harm and think, I need to protect them because I love them. And so that was my way of connecting to Nancy Reagan, not absolving her of what she did in my book or what she did in this country,
mm-hmm.
but understanding where she was coming from.
Yeah, I think what I want to know is right now, there is a lot happening in this moment in history for America,
yeah.
right? You have kids protesting on campus. They are protesting this deadly, brutal war in Gaza. And we're also seeing the institutional response to that, right? And just for those, and while all this is happening during an election year,
right.
you know, between we have an election where two of the primary candidates, no disrespect to the third party candidates, are arguably unpopular.
Inarguably, yeah.
You know, and I am looking at this, and what I'm seeing is I have to understand so much of the past, different moments of the past. I'm trying to make sense of the present. What am I really seeing? And I'm also worried because I'm thinking about the future of all of this,
right?
And, you know, you say, I want to paraphrase, but you say, you know, we experience time linear, and, you know, chronology. One thing happens, the next thing is a country. But mentally and emotionally,
yep.
we're experiencing past, present, future all at the same time in different places, like at once. And I want to ask you, if you were to write a story that took place today, where would you start it?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is I have no idea. But if I started it today, I would have to provide some sense of how I got to today and what's at stake today. Mm-hmm. You were just essentially doing that, saying, look, the world feels like it's on fire right now. But the world doesn't feel like it's on fire because the world was born on fire.
Mm.
It feels like it's on fire because a complex, intractable, religious, political, psychic rift has reached a point of conflagration. And America didn't just wake up and find itself kind of in the thrall of an attention-seeking demagogue who's full of nativism and violence, and with the other, you know, sort of party nominating somebody that people can't get behind. Like, that didn't just happen. There are very particular and complex and nuanced reasons. And it's really the novelist's job and the sort of the creative writer to not just say, here are the events, but to try to figure out, well, what is the meaning of these events? To strip away the kind of lesser defenses. So when I hear grievance, wherever it is, let's just say at a rally of a major candidate, and people are just roaring with grievance, if you peel that back somewhere underneath that, the writer's job is to say, oh, there's grief underneath that. And if I hear that there are people who are alienated and sort of numbed out, you say, well, let me peel that back. And what's underneath that is almost always thwarted desire, some burden of hope that's been too painful, and so you put up a mask. And the same thing with rage. When people are raging, underneath that, if you strip it away, is sorrow. There's a little kernel of sorrow that rage is trying to burn off, and it never does.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but this book is the book, Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow. It's a kind of a plea to people to make more time to read. Put down the screen, read or write, but, you know, get into some literature, get into these inner worlds and stuff, you know? What are some ways people can make a habit of reading more? Like, what are some steps folks can take? Because I feel like, you know, we live in a time where the screens are raining right now.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I think what I would say is not that anybody, like, I don't know, nobody needs a lecture. What I was trying to do in the book was to say, look, you're stuck with your inner life. Mm-hmm. There's no getting away from it. And that's an inner life that's sometimes filled with joy and happiness and a sense of like accomplishment, but more often it's really full of doubt and frustration and feeling thwarted and confused. There are entire stories that are there to keep you company and assure you that you are not the only person ever to walk that particular path. And that feeling of solace, I don't think you can get from usually from the internet, because the internet preys on our feeling of wanting to be distracted from that kind of inner turmoil. And it, every time we have a little moment of sadness or we might like kind of lurch into those feelings, we can just pick up the phone and start doom scrolling or whatever it is will allow us to retreat into those defensive emotions. Oh man, the news is terrible. Things are going to hell in a handbasket, dot, dot, dot. Or my team won or my team lost or whatever keeps us from that kind of inner sense that life is fragile, that we're fragile, our emotions are always, you know, so easy to upset the people around us. We're trying to take care of them. We also want to feel taken care of by them. That's often very insecure. And I feel like we're sort of constantly fronting, and literature and stories are a place where you don't have to front anymore. Like, if it's a well-engineered story, it's going to get you into the deepest part, the darkest part of the map. And you're going to realize, okay, that part of the map is never going to go away. It's always going to exist. And it's also not empty. There are a lot of people who are in a similar state of bewilderment, confusion, the need for some feeling that they're not alone in that kind of confusion.
That was author Steve Almond. His newest book, Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, is about writing and the human instinct to make sense of our lives through stories.